I don't know which I'd prefer to be, really, the film censors, knowing which part to cut out, or a preacher having to expound the passage. But this is an incident in God's Word. I hope you like illustrations in preaching. I hope you find them helpful. An illustration, a story, an insight, an example is sometimes there to shed light on a situation, to a parallel, sometimes a real-life story that parallels the truth, to seek to give us some meaning and some insight into it. The point is not just to tell a story, but to point to a deeper truth. And I say that because really this whole chapter of Judges 19 is an illustration in preaching. That's what it is. It's an example. It's a real-life example. In fact, this whole section, the last five chapters of Judges, the only way to understand it is it's an example in the sermon of the writer of Judges to say this. You want to understand how terrible things can get when people abandon God? Have a look at this. You want to realize how tragic the human heart is when left to its own condition? Have a look at this. You want to understand how people live when they ignore God as their true king? Then read these accounts. These are true life illustrations. They're not made up. They're not fiction. They're not fable. They're not just something that a preacher dreamed up in his head. They really happen. But they're illustration. They're there to make the point to us that we understand how tragic the abandonment of God is. I've called this evening's title, as you'll see on the sheet, The Slide into Moral Chaos. And that's exactly what the writer is seeking to illustrate here. It's not so crucial for us to understand the timing of this for exactly that reason, that it's an illustration. We don't know exactly the timing. We're not told everybody's name, are we, of the characters in this account, even though it's a true account. I suspect there could have been 50 or 100, maybe 1,000 incidents of moral outrage during these 300, 350 years of the time of the Judges. Could easily have been. The writer could have picked any of those, but he chooses this one because of its enormity and its terrible crimes. If chapter 17 was about religious chaos that we saw, a man setting up his own private shrine, his own idols and his priests, chapter 18 that we looked at last time was about the peril and the disaster of self-made religion. Well, chapter 19 to the end, the next three chapters, we move the camera angle from religious chaos to moral chaos. We're focusing not on chaos in the church, but chaos in our own human hearts. It's not very comfortable to read. It's even less comfortable to think about in its significance for us. They're about moral chaos, these three chapters, 19, 20, and 21. We don't have to think very long before we realize the relevancy of passages and messages about moral chaos in the day in which we live. This chapter doesn't include any of the major salvation heroes that we've met through the book of Judges. But he's picked this incident and stuck it on the end to say, you've seen all of the flaws in these judges, these characters all the way through. You've seen the sins and the backslidings of God's people. But you think you've seen it all? Well, get a load of this. And on the last part of the book, he shows how terrible, really, it could have got. The one he chose, I hope you agree that to this chapter it's gruesome and it's appalling, isn't it? Maybe it's enough to provoke us to anger and to outrage that something like this happens. And then comes his punch in verse 1. Without a king in Israel, these things happened. Israel had no king, had no leadership, had no moral compass, had nobody to remind people back to the scriptures. If we live without being reminded about God's ways, his righteousness, his character, his holiness, his law, his covenant, the glory of Jesus Christ, that he had to die for sin, as we were thinking about this morning. If we ignore those things, if we're not in touch with God, then your life is on a helter-skelter and so is mine. Down, ever-increasing chaos and depravity, sliding around in the mud, without a king in our hearts, without the king in Israel. Unless we submit to God's laws, we submit to moral chaos, willfully and with purpose and with choice. To make any sense of the passage, we need to take chapter 19 and 20 together, really. I won't say all that much about chapter 20. I'll leave you to read it at home. But certainly about 19 and the early parts of chapter 20. Next week, we'll look at chapter 21, which shows some of the consequences, the fallout of this tragic act. But also in chapter 21, we see glimpses of God's recovery mission, his grace to restore and keep his people. Can there be any grace in the midst of this depravity? Well, just a little bit. And we'll see some of that next time. But before we just dive into the passage, I just want to say this. When you read passages like this, please understand, you don't have to agree with them or approve of them. When you read passages like this in the Bible, not at all. That's part of the point. This devastation that we read of is when the people of God are not living as they ought to live. They're princes. They ought to be clothed in glorious robes, wondering at their inheritance, and instead they're pigs wallowing in the mud of moral depravity. So you don't have to approve of that, just as you wouldn't approve of your children taking off their clothes and going to live with the pigs in the sty and rolling around in the mud. You wouldn't approve of that. So we don't need to approve of what we read in times like this. This chapter, of course, was one of those odd passages that Richard Dawkins picked out recently in the program Root of All Evil. He picked out exactly this chapter and looked at the moral outrage and said, what kind of God condones that behavior? The answer is, not the Christian God. This chapter is not here to condone it at all. As usual, he's missed the point. The context of this passage is to say that if you ignore God, you end up living like this, not if you follow God. To grasp any portion of Scripture and its meaning, we must grasp why the author wrote it, and that is the point of these last chapters. There were five scenes that the movie director would shoot before the censors cut them all out in chapter 19. Let's look at the five scenes as we trace this horrendous plot. The first scene, verses 1 and 2, is an unfaithful concubine. We don't know much about concubines these days. Thankfully, we don't have them anymore. But before we get to the concubine, we meet verse 1, a Levite, another Levite. Not the same one as we've been reading about the last two chapters, but another one. But he was from the remote hill country of Ephraim, all the same. And we see here in verse 1, he takes a concubine. It was a common thing for him to do in those days. People were allowed to have more than one wife in those days. You can't today. God doesn't smile on more than one wife today. It's illegal, and quite rightly so. In those days, it wasn't illegal to have more than one wife. And the wives kind of had a pecking order. You had your main wife, sometimes you had a subsidiary wife, maybe a few more, and then you kind of had your concubine, which was kind of a mini wife or sort of a moderate wife. It was allowed in Old Testament law. There were certain differences. You did have to commit to them, you did have to care for them, but you didn't need a wedding ceremony. So those people getting married this year, don't think you can sort of ditch the wedding ceremony and have concubines. They were often slaves and servants. They were kind of a lower status than wives. The Levite took a concubine. Should he have done that? We can't really say. But as far as we know, he didn't have another wife. He didn't break any law. He didn't commit a crime just in taking this concubine. Now, we can't really say that. But at least she was from within the country of Israel. She was from Bethlehem, look, verse 1 in Judah. At least he didn't take a foreign concubine, which would have been even worse. As far as we know, he took his relationship with her seriously. But verse 2, she didn't. She was unfaithful to him. She took another man and then ran away. He calls himself, or he's called the husband in verse 3, so we can see how seriously he takes it. But she's run off back to her father's house after she's broken the heart of a Levite. So we bring this story to a beginning with a broken heart in the heart of this particular Levite. But he seeks to resolve the situation. Look, after 4 months, the end of verse 2, he's ready to forgive her and take her back. That would be an incredible act, wouldn't it? To forgive somebody for that and to bring them back. He wants to reconcile. They've had a cooling off period, but he doesn't want it to end. So he's serious enough about to bring her back, even though she's been unfaithful. That's scene 1. Scene 2, verses 2 to 10, is the mission to recover her. He goes off to try and get his lady back. He finds her very easily, but he doesn't get her back so easily. When he turns up, her father, his father-in-law, is very keen to see him. Maybe he thinks this man's admirable for wanting his concubine back after she's been unfaithful. But anyway, he gives him very good and persuasive hospitality. And the man can't seem to get away. The food is so good, the wine is so good, the company is so good, he can't get away. What a contrast there to the lack of hospitality that a man finds later on in Gibeah. What a contrast. He can't seem to get away. Eventually, after lots of days and lots of begging, he drags himself away, taking the concubine with him. He comes across as a bit of a weak-willed man, doesn't he? He's so easily persuaded to stay. His mission was to get his wife and go home again. But he's so easily persuaded to stay, and that comes out later in the story. Oh, we need to pray that our wills wouldn't be so weak, that we would so easily be distracted from our fundamental mission under God, to reconcile people back to Christ. He's got this weak will, he's easily persuaded. But anyway, his mission to recover, and they set out. That's scene two. Scene three is a dangerous journey, verses 11 to 21. He goes off, but the journey is too long for one day. He can't get home before the evening, so he needs to stay the night somewhere. He could call in at this strange city he's going by, but he's too wise for that, verse 12. He says, no, we won't go into an alien city. We won't go there, into Jerusalem. It was populated by alien people, not Israelites. So we're going to go on to Gibeah. It's only 3 miles. We'll make it. And when we reach Gibeah, they're our own people. They'll look after us. You're always safer with your own people, aren't you? So you might think. He thought he'd be safer in the Israelite town. So they press on, they make it before nightfall. It makes sense, seems to be a good plan. They arrive in Gibeah, and they hang around in the square, nobody invites them home. There's no travel lodges in Gibeah, not yet. Eventually an old man turns up in the square, he's been working out in the fields, and he takes them home and gives them accommodation for the night. We ought to be able to presume on that. If we're in a pickle, accommodation and help from the people of God. The man went to Gibeah because he thought the people of God would be good-hearted. Actually, they were tragically hearted, weren't they? But the people of God, you ought to be able to count on them in a jam. You ought to be able to. We ought to be able to rely on one another. Show hospitality, Christian brother and sister. It ought to be part of our unity and fellowship. That when the chips are down, I can always count on the members of my church. It always ought to be the case. That's how this man thought. He was badly let down. Pray that we wouldn't take an example. Scene 4 is the night of terror, verses 22 to 28. What tragic events happen in Gibeah that night? The situation turns just awesome, awful. We see moral bankruptcy in this Benjamite town. They ought to be the people of God. In fact, in chapter 20, did you notice how the writer stressed that they met, verse 1, before the Lord in Mizpah? How he stressed that they were the people of God. A bit further down, I can't quite find the verse. He stressed that they were that these were the people of God in Israel that were doing this terrible thing. These were the people of God. It ought not to have been like this at all. The rowdy crowd assembles in the street. They come and they start banging on the door. The NIV verse 22 under makes the case, really. Pounding on the door sounds like you're hitting with your fist. Actually, they were throwing themselves at the door. That verse means they were throwing their shoulders at the door. They were so desperate to get into that house, they were even throwing themselves at the door, because they wanted a perverted knowledge of the visitor in town. It all reads a bit like Genesis 19, what happened in Sodom, doesn't it? You remember when Lot was there and the angels came to visit and they tried to get in to get at the visitors. It's unmistakable, almost word for word account of the terrible things that happened in Sodom. And that's what's going on here. Even with the old man who had opened up the house, he calls these villains his friends, doesn't he? He goes out to plead with them, verse 23. No, my friends, he says, there can't be any friends of yours. Don't hang around with friends like that. You don't want those kind of friends. Even his plan to appease him is to send out his two daughters, or his virgin daughter and the concubine, the two ladies, to save the skins of the men. That's not courage. That's not men standing up and being men. Actually, we don't read, do we, of him sending his daughter out? It's only the concubine that eventually gets sent out. They don't want the daughter that they the lady they've already met. They want a new thrill, this visitor from outside. Life away from God always seeks these new dangers, these new thrills. You can never be satisfied when you're living without God as your king. The people of Gibeah exactly show that. The concubine is taken. She's repeatedly raped all night. She's beaten. She's abused. She's left for dead there at the doorway. verse 26. What a graphic verse it is. She crawls back to the gateway of the house where her master's staying. She falls down at the door with her hands, as it were, over the threshold, and there she dies. What a night of absolute terror. The Bible doesn't condone what went on that night. Chapter 20, verse 3, it's called an awful thing. Verse 6, it's called a lewd and disgraceful act. Verse 10, the end of verse 10, it's called vileness done in Israel. Verse 12, it's called an awful crime. The Bible calls it just what we call it. These were terrible events in this night of terror. Was the Levite innocent in all of this? Well, he claims innocent later, as we'll see. But surely he wasn't. He let his concubine go out. He seemed to not care very much. He seemed to sort of go back inside and have some sleep. How would you sleep through the night when you knew that was going on outside? He appears to be a coward during the night, and he appears to be callous in the morning. Ladies, what do you make of verse 27? He gets up, he goes out, he sees her at the doorway, crushed and smashed, and he says, verse 28, get up, let's go. He's not going to win any Mr. and Mrs. contest there, is he, for his compassion, his understanding. The man's heart doesn't even go out to this woman. He doesn't realize she's dead until there's no answer. He puts her on his donkey and they travel home to the place that they're from. The reaction of the tribes later in chapter 20, the little bit that we read, was of seething anger and punishment, wasn't it, against the people that had committed this crime. But the truth, the stark truth is that virtually no one in this account was without fault. The Levite, the old man, the concubine, the people of God, the men of Gibeah, everybody we read of, all have some fault. Surely we see the tragedy, as we see in our own day, that in days of moral chaos, even the people you ought to be able to trust let you down, don't they? The Levite, what was a Levite? The Levite was someone who led the people of God in worship. And yet here he is, and those of his family, letting people down. Those of his own people, his own kith and kin. We live in a day, don't we, where even our father figures, our judges, our leaders, our rulers, our elders, they all let us down, don't they? They often fail us. It's a sign we're living in days of moral chaos, and we need to heed the warnings of chapters like this. Scene 5 is a shocking sign, verses 29 and 30. If the crime that we've read was shocking, then how about the sign? That was even more, wasn't it? The sign made by this bereaved husband master. It was equally shocking. He'd stumbled across this corpse in the morning, quite literally stumbled across it, carried her home, cut her up into 12 pieces, and mailed one to each of the tribes in Israel. My goodness me. Such a thing has never been seen, verse 30. Such a thing has never been seen or done. Not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Think about it. Consider it. Tell us what to do. What a tragic thing to chop up a lady and send it around. It was shocking, but in its nature, on purpose, to reveal what a horrific incident had gone on the night before. Imagine receiving that in the post. Imagine DHL knocking on your door tomorrow. And a 12th of the pastor's wife has arrived in the mail for you. Hope it doesn't. Friends, what will it take for us to be shown what we have done against God and how we've lived against Him? What would it take for Israel to be rallied to the state of their hearts and the state of their moral chaos? What will it take? What would need to be in the parcel that arrives on your door before we take seriously the mess of our days, the mess of our moral chaos? We're often told the 21st century is advancing in so many ways, aren't we? What would you need to mail to your MP to convince him that in terms of morality we've gone down the pan in many ways, haven't we, with a decline? If you stepped out of time 100 years ago into today, would you be outraged at what you see around you? I suspect you would. But we're not outraged because we don't see the signs as we ought to as the people of God. Remember, these are the people of God. This is not a pagan nation. This is a people that ought to be a holy people. The shocking sign was meant to provoke a response and punishment. And it did, of course, have that effect, didn't it? It reverberations around the whole nation. It was like a pebble, or not a pebble, I was going to say a pebble dropped in a pond, but it's like a great big boulder dropped in a pond, and the ripples went everywhere. Sometimes crimes are so horrific, aren't they? The whole nation is an outrage. You know, you remember James Bulger. You remember the Moors murder, some of you. We remember, of course, the Soham tragedy. Horrific crimes. The whole nation is up in outrage. And that's what happened here in Israel. Chapter 20 is the story of exactly that. 400,000 soldiers get together in verse 2. The whole of Israel assembles. They come even from Gilead, verse 1. The people in Gilead were the other side of the river. They never came over the river, you remember. Earlier on, we read in Judges, they weren't bothered to come. It was too far for any lesser issue like fighting the Philistines, but for a crime like this, even the people from Gilead were prepared to come over the river and journey to the meeting at Mizpah. The whole of Israel came. It was outrageous, such a thing, to respond to this crime. And chapter 20 is a story of four things happening. First of all, it's the trial, verses 1 to 7. The plan of the Levite to shock and outrage the nation, it worked. The leaders come together, this council of all the tribe, this assembly, and they hear the evidence. They ask the Levite to give him the story. What did you make of the story in verse 5? This is what the Levite says. Well, verses 4 and 5. So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house, intending to kill me. They raped my concubine and she died. That's got parts of the truth in it. But it's not the full truth, is it? Certain bits are left out, aren't they? Like his complicity in the whole deal. He's twisted the events. He's disguised the fact that he was actually at fault too. His coldness, his callousness, his unwillingness to stand up for her. They didn't say at all that they were there to kill him. They were just there after the girls. And after abusing him, not to kill him. So he kind of twists things. He's not he's economical with the truth. He's seeking to create anger and revenge and outrage amongst the people of God, but he's covered up the sin of his own heart. We often do that, don't we? You know, the command of God to us as his people is not to give kind of the truth, but to not bear a false witness. Thou shalt not bear false witness. He did that. In front of 400,000 troops, he bore a false witness. And we must be very careful in reporting incidents which bear a false witness and hide our own complicity, whereas we complain about others. We must be very careful of that. Another alarming point about this trial is the unity that Israel managed to gather. Just remember some of the other accounts and stories we've looked at in Judges. Do you remember when they were attacking the Philistines, and then attacking the Amorites, and then attacking the Amalekites around about, attacking these nations when they needed help, and some of the tribes did what? Well, you don't need our help. We're not really bothered. They weren't willing to step up to the mark. But when an outrage like this had happened, well, they came. How come they were prepared to unite against the Benjamites, their own people, for one of their crimes? Remember, the Benjamites, the Gibeons, were one of the tribes of Israel. They're one of their kith and kin, one of the Israelite 12 tribes. Why were the whole of the nation of God prepared to unite together against one of the people of God and not against the enemy of God? That's tragic, isn't it? Why such unity here? For the first time in the book of Judges, we have unity amongst the tribes. Why? It's tragic, isn't it? I can only let you imagine what the parallels are for the Church of Jesus Christ. How sometimes our unity against one of ourselves, one of our own, rather than against the enemy of God. We must beware of that. It's tragic, this unity here. Then their plan of retribution, verses 8 to 13. They agree. The other 11 tribes agree to go after the tribe of Benjamin. United punitive action. They raise this massive army. One person of dubious morals, the Levite, has turned the whole nation. Kind of reminds you of a fascist state almost, how one person is able to turn the whole nation. It's Mussolini, it's Hitler, it's somebody of dubious morals turning the whole nation. It might well happen in our stable democratic nations too, over the years to come, I'm certain of it. One person with dubious morality able to persuade and turn a nation. Anyway, the Levite managed to do that. They go against the Gibeons. They ask for the men of Gibeah to be given up. A bit like when we went to the Libyans, do you remember, and asked for the Lockerbie suspects to be released for trial. And initially the Libyans said, no, we're not releasing them. And so the Benjamites, this tribe, refused to give up the suspects who had committed this particular crime. They were a bunch of social louts, were the Gibeons. But Benjamin wanted to defend their own. They were defensive of their family. As one commentator puts it, blood is sometimes thicker than covenant. You know, our family defensiveness can sometimes be a barrier to the Spirit of God. It was here. And the rest of the chapter 20 we won't read. That's the attack. And you can read it at home. How the rest of the Israelite tribes, once the Gibeons are not surrendered, they go against the Benjamites. An enormous war ensues. There was fighting in the conflict to and fro. And eventually the Benjamites were overpowered and annihilated. This was civil war, really. As you read chapter 20, you read of civil war between the divided tribes of Israel, brother against brother. And you'll read it, countless thousands were killed on both sides. It ended in a total bloodbath. When you read it, you almost think that it's more about kind of vengeful excess than of real true justice. But we do see Israel inquiring of God. Three times in chapter 20, you see them asking God for a sign. You often see that amongst the people of God. When you get into deep trouble, you inquire of God and ask for his help. And they did sometimes here. We also see them weeping and fasting and offering sacrifices to God. Verse 26, for example, of chapter 20. Then the Israelites, all the people, went up to Bethel. And there they sat weeping before the Lord. Why were they weeping before the Lord? Well, we're told earlier on. Because they lost all these thousands of people. And I want to ask this question. Why are they prepared to weep before God over the people they lose in battle and not to weep before God over the state of their hearts, their utter idolatry, their moral chaos, and their absolute abandonment of the covenant of God? Why aren't they weeping over that? They're weeping over lost lives, not over repentance. That's what we do in Britain today. We weep over our lost ones. And someone important and who's captured our hearts dies, like Princess Diana. We weep, and we can't stop weeping. The nation wept its eyes out. But it won't weep over sin. It won't weep over moral decay and corruption. And the Israelites here, they show us that the people of God are weeping over the wrong thing. And oh, if they'd wept over the state of their hearts first and returned to God, maybe all of this absolute tragedy might have been averted. And even as the chapter finishes with the punishment, we must see the bigger theological picture that actually God is judging both sides. The Benjamites lose many, many in conflict, and so do the other tribes of Israel too. Many lives are lost. And it's not just wasted lives. It is God judging both sides for their sin. God was behind it. Look at verse 35. It does say that God bruised the Benjamites. Look, if you want to know what God thought about this terrible atrocity, then look at verse 35. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day the Israelites struck down 25,100 Benjamites, all armed with the swords. It was the Lord that did it, notice. The Lord defeated. So God did strike the Benjamites because of these terrible crimes. The Lord did judge. And yet Israel, the other tribes, were judged too for their idolatry. 40,000 men were lost in just 2 days fighting. And yet even despite all of that, God preserved his people Israel. Despite their moral collapse, despite the civil war, despite their sinfulness, he still preserved his people. He couldn't see his people wiped out. He preserved them. He hung on to them. Yes, the town of Gibeah was wiped out. Other Benjamite towns were. They were devastated. Punishment was severe and total because the crime was so outrageous. It's not right to say God isn't appalled by crimes like this, because he was. And you can see it clearly if you read these accounts. The prophet Hosea, writing later, referred back to these days. These days of Gibeah, with a kind of a summary condemnation. Let me just give you the two sentences that prophet Hosea, pointing back to the sin of Israel, in chapter 9, verse 9, Hosea said this: about the people of God. They have sunk deep into corruption, as in the days of Gibeah, referring to this chapter. As in the days of Gibeah, God will remember their wickedness and punish them for their sins. The next chapter it's mentioned as well, chapter 10, verse 9. Since the days of Gibeah, you have sinned, O Israel, and there you have remained. Did not war overtake the evildoers in Gibeah? It was the judgment of God. We can't always say that when bad things happen after crimes, we know. But in this case, we can, because the Lord was in it and he judged it. So God is appalled, as we're appalled. My question is, if only we were as consistent as God. We're appalled at this. And we want God to be appalled. If only we were as appalled at crimes against God's honor and his name as he is. Are we prepared to be consistent about that? Let me conclude with some applications about these chapters. There are some big lessons for us. The first one I want to make is this. How should we live in times that mirror these times? Rapes and murders of women go on every day in our times. This concubine is just representative of 21st century Western life. What happened to her? How should we live in times like that as the people of God? Well, surely if chapter 20 teaches us anything, it should teach us that we shouldn't take the sword of retribution into our own hands in days like that. That's not how we should live. We must realize that God will do that in his own time. What we must do is live in a world of chaos and injustice. Yes, seeking to do what we can as salt and light in the community, of course. But we live in a world of chaos and injustice with one big action we can take, and it's this. We can stand out as holy, consecrated followers of God. Moral people in an immoral world. We can make a difference in that sense. We can be clean and holy and straight. That will impact the world. Friends, you can't stop all these crimes, but you can live differently. You can be like a light in a crooked and perverse world. That's how Paul puts it in Philippians 2, isn't it? It's exactly what he writes, how applicable it is to this incident. Philippians 2, 14. Do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God, without fault in a crooked and depraved generation in which you shine like stars in the universe as you hold out the word of life. Be like star in a dark and barren universe. We can live like that. We ought to live like that. We're called to live like Christ. How different was the morality and the holiness of Christ in the midst of such religious and moral chaos of his death? And so it should be for us. Our lives shouldn't be those full of retribution. It should be those full of purity and morality within the church, within our families, amongst Christians. The way that Peter put it on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, verse 40, crying out to the people of his day, he said, save yourselves from this corrupt generation. We could say that just as equally today, couldn't we? We must be saved in the midst of this corrupt generation. And living like lights, like stars, in a day like that. Our day is just like this. But our lives must be different. The people of God were sucked in. These are chapters about the people of God. They're not chapters about society. We're much more comfortable, aren't we, saying society is evil and the church isn't. Is that really so? We take the lessons of these chapters seriously. It was the people of God who were sucked in and drawn in to such moral chaos. But another application I want to make, and it's this. Passages like this, these chapters, they should leave us with a thirst in our souls. A thirst in the throat of our soul, if I can put it like that, for the true king. That's the problem, isn't it, in verse 1 of chapter 19. In those days Israel had no king. We saw it earlier in chapter 17. Turn to the very last verse in Judges. You see it there. In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. These are the consequences of people living without Christ, living without God's rule, living without his covenant obligations. And these chapters should leave in us an unsettled thirst that won't be quenched without Christ the King coming. We must long for it. We don't want to live in days like that. We don't want to be part of incidents like that. There must be this thirst for the King. And I want to suggest three ways that we should thirst for the King in the midst of devastating depravity. Number one, we must thirst for more of the kingly reign of Christ in my own soul. We must thirst for that first. We must pray the prayer that David prayed in Psalm 19, verse 13. When he prayed a prayer about his own heart and his own sin. And he said in Psalm 19, "Keep your servant from willful sins. May they not rule over me. Then will I be blameless and innocent of great transgression. May the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart, be pleasing in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer." The rule of Christ in our hearts, that our thoughts and our words might be pleasing in the sight of God. Lord, deliver me from willful sins. To desire the reign of Christ in our own soul, or to be like him, to shun sin. It wasn't just that the people here had no king. It was the fact that they did what they saw fit. Everyone did as he saw fit, what was right in his own eyes. That's the declaration of independence. I'll do what I see fit amongst the people of God. Let us thirst for more of the King in our own heart. That I might be like Christ, whatever the cost. That I might be like Christ, whatever the people around me say. That I might be like Christ. To encourage and support and be an example to my brothers around me. My friend, the greatest thing that you can do for me is to be like Christ. The greatest thing I can do for you is to be like Christ. The greatest way in which we can live as a church is to be like Christ. The greatest way we can reach out is not to be as relevant and in touch as we can be, although we want to be that, but to be like Christ. To say to our morally depraved culture, there is a different way to live. It's to be like Christ. Those that are saved will be purified and made more and more like him. So a thirst for more of the King in our own souls. Friends, if we have moral outrage against this passage, but our hearts are just as stubborn and willful, then we've not learned the lesson. We're not thirsting for the King. Second way we should thirst for the King, surely, is to thirst for more of the reign of Christ in our land, our nation. Surely we must read this passage, watch the news, read the papers, and then say, Lord, if you will not come to our land, how shall we be revived? Passages like this should lead us as a church to pause and to get on our knees and to weep at the state of sin and to ask God earnestly that he would outpour his spirit on our land. To pray for revival of the church. To pray for revival of godliness and holiness. To pray for the conviction of sin. To pray that it would be widespread. That repentance would be so powerful and overwhelming. It almost would be intoxicating because people are crying out to God. Amongst the Christians first. And then amongst the world. That sinners would be restored to God. That holiness and prayer would be promoted as necessities they should be rather than optional extras they seem to often be. A reviving our land with a pouring out of the Spirit of God. When the King comes, his reign is expansive. And as a church, we must pray that the reign of Christ would be expansive in our land. That a day would come, that the King would come upon our days and show people their sin. When the Spirit is poured out, it will convict men of sin and righteousness and judgment. We must pray for more of the Spirit of God on preaching, upon witness. And that he would convict people of their sins. Things like this happening every day. So more of the reign of Christ in my own soul. More of the kingly reign of Christ in our land today. Showing people their sin. And bringing them back to him in reconciliation and conversion. And then third, surely, it must leave us with a thirst somewhere in our throats of our souls. For the kingly reign of Christ. To return soon to us in glorifying fullness. Oh Lord, don't leave the world like this. Lord, Don't let sin have the final word. Lord, don't let moral corruption be all this world is about. Lord, come and glorify the world again. Beautify it. Restore it. Glorify it. Come back to us. Even so, Lord, come quickly. Surely it should give us a thirst in our souls for the return of Christ, for the marriage supper of the Lamb, that no longer would we have to live in a polluted day like this, but that his people would be gathered in, and that Christ would reign in a city of gold, and his people would finally be what they ought to be, spotless and made blameless without stain. My friend, do you thirst for those things in your soul, in our land, and upon this earth? True believers surely will thirst for those things. May sin never have the last word. May the grace of God and the rule of Christ always have the last word. And may God forgive us for our many sins.